Hi everyone, welcome. Thank you for coming this evening. I know most of you, those of you I don't, I hope to meet. We're very happy to see you, and we're very happy to welcome back Lonnie Jarrett to the school. He hasn't been here in a while, and we hope, he's here now, and we hope he's again here very soon. For those of you who don't know Lonnie, he has been a scholar of Chinese medicine for now 30 years. He teaches and writes on the inner tradition of Chinese medicine and pulse reading. He has a clinical practice in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. He has published 2 books, which you'll see outside, and I know many of you have them. He'd be happy to autograph them for you tonight if you don't own them. He also is a frequent writer and publisher. You can find his work on Spirit Path
Press.
Spirit Press.
Spirit Path Press.
SpiritPathPress.com. Now you will not forget it.
And the articles are all up at nourishingdestiny.com.
So, let me welcome Lonnie back to the Academy.
So, thank you very much. I never have any idea what I'm going to say at these things. I always think to myself, how can I possibly talk for an hour, hour and a half? So what we're going to do tonight is I'm just going to speak for a while and then hopefully take questions. So it would be good if you asked questions that had something to do whatever it is I talk about. But as long as it has to do with Chinese medicine generally, it'll be fine. So it's very nice to be back at the school. I used to come every year and teach when it was down in Miami. And then I came up to Gainesville once. Dorit, who started the school, came in. She was my patient. And I'm violating HIPAA here, but... well, going to go to hell one way or another. So, and she came into my office and she said, JR wants me to start an acupuncture school. Do you think it would be a good idea? And I said, well, you'd be the woman to do it, but you should go in with your eyes open. And it's very gratifying to... that was a long time ago. It was in the early 90s, I think. Could that have been right, Joanne?
Yes. 1990?
Is that right
about?
Yeah, so it's a long time ago now. I opened my practice in 86. So anyway, late 80s, I was treating her, and she lived a few towns over. And then she went to acupuncture school and open school, so it's totally gratifying to be back. And the school is my first choice recommendation when people call me and write me from anywhere in the world and say, where should I study acupuncture? So I always give them the name of this school first and then the name of other schools. If I give them the name of this school and they say they don't want to go to Florida, then I will try to find some other school. But this is the school that I send most of the students to. I think it has a really beautiful heart. And I think the five-element tradition is a very deep and profound tradition on which to base a lifetime of clinical practice. So it's much easier to put TCM on top of this, because this has a soul and a spirit, than it is to do TCM and then to get this after the fact. So I think this is a very strong foundation for clinical practice. And I began studying it myself. Well, I wrote my college entrance essay in part on Chinese medicine in 1975. And I started studying with a graduate of J.R. Worsley in 1980. And then I've been practicing in Stockbridge since 1986. And in 1984, 4 or 5, when I was in acupuncture school, I met Leon Hammer. And he was coming down to study with Bob and Diane and to just meet with them. Bob Duggan and Diane Conley at TAI. And I was in school and he would come into our class and sit with us and talk to us about Chinese medicine a bit. And when I graduated in 86, I remember there was this pretty cool cat who I met a few times down there. And I vaguely remembered that he lived in upstate New York somewhere. So I called Bob Duggan to ask who he was and where he lived, and it turned out it was Leon and that he was practicing in Saratoga, New York, which is just an hour from my office. And so I called Leon and started studying with him, and I would go follow him around clinic all day and offer to get a teaching career together for him. So for 10 years, I ran all his classes out of my office. So that's pretty much my background in the medicine is Worsley five-element acupuncture for the constitutional part, combined with what's now called the Shenhammer pulse system for the physiology. And I find those two together to be a very deep and profound winning combination. And that's sort of just the background on me. And some of you are going to be here for the weekend class, and we'll go very deep into these different perspectives. What I'm going to talk about tonight is just the general perspective. This is usually the lecture that I would give for the first hour to hour and a half of almost any course I teach. So the thing is, I'm going to let you in on a secret that most of us who teach in the profession only give two or three lectures, and we just keep renaming them to keep people interested. Because, I mean, how much can you know, right? You just find different ways to put it together. And whenever I teach, I begin the class, and I want to give a broad philosophical overview. So I'm a teacher who really emphasizes context. Because as you know, in Chinese medicine, everything is contextual, right? The confounding thing about starting to study Chinese medicine is you can't actually know what anything means that you're reading or learning until you already know everything else. Because anything that you're studying in any moment implicitly references the entire body of knowledge which you haven't learned yet. So that's why you can take the same lecture 15 times. I mean, I could, if Leon would give an introductory pulse weekend right now, I've been practicing his pulse system for 30 years, and I could sit there and you would hear things new. You would hear them fresh. And you would remember hearing them 30 years ago and go, oh, I thought I understood then, but now I'm totally getting it. Someone said on acupuncture, they put acupuncturists on Facebook, you know, the news group, it's where old acupuncturists go to die. And where new acupuncturists go to confound them. So somebody put up a post last week saying, I've been practicing 4 years, and I really feel like I'm starting to get the medicine, to understand the medicine. And I wrote, give it another 30 years, and then you'll really be starting to understand the medicine. So everything is contextual, and there are three broad contexts in which I teach, and these are an integral perspective, an evolutionary perspective, and a spiritual perspective. So everything I teach is in those three contexts: integral, evolutionary, and spiritual. And I thought I'd take some time to talk about what those three perspectives are, and then I'd be very happy. And you can ask questions as we go along, too, and then I'll talk until I think I've sort of covered it, and then I'll just ask for questions and we can have a discussion about things. So first, integral. So we could do a year-long course on integral medicine. Do you understand? It would be very easy for me to teach like 5 days a week, 8 hours a day for a month on integral medicine. But we could boil it all down to the recognition of oneness. So the term integral was coined by an Indian gentleman, East Indian gentleman named Sri Aurobindo, who is the formulator of integral yoga. And when he was a very young boy, he was taken by his father out of India to England to be educated in England. And his father would let him have no contact with Indian culture whatsoever because he deemed it inferior, not modern. Right? This would have been late 1800s, early 1900s, and not modern, full of superstition. He went to England, and Aurobindo had a vision that it was his job to go to England, start a revolution, and throw the English out of India. And he did just that and was put in prison. And while in prison, he had a vision that the only context in which the entire Eastern teaching made sense was an evolutionary context. And he escaped from prison to a small French enclave that gave him immunity in Pondicherry and protected him for the rest of his life where he did his work. And he founded Integral Yoga, wrote like 190 books. His work is just absolutely brilliant, and he coined the term integral in relationship to yoga. And what he meant by integral yoga was a practice of yoga that left no part of the human being behind. So integral for him was the practice of yoga that left no dimension of the self behind. So when we talk about integral medicine, we're talking about aspiring to practice a medicine that leaves no dimension of the self behind. And we're only going to be able to reach every dimension of the self within the patient. We can only practice a medicine that doesn't negate any part of the self to the degree that we have a non-abstract living relationship with every dimension of the self within ourselves. So it is true in the context of medicine and holistic medicine, specifically in our case, that you don't have to have had sciatica to treat sciatica, right? If that were the case, men would never be able to treat women for infertility, right? So you don't have to have had conditions to treat them. But when it comes to the increase of human integrity, you're never going to be able to lead a human being to a greater integrity of the self than you yourself have been willing to embrace within you. Otherwise, it would be abstract and hypocritical. And what I found is that as I go around and as I read the news groups and as I read articles and as I listen to people in the profession talk and as I listen to my patients, I recognize that most human beings have a very superficial relationship to their own self. If you ask them who they are, or you listen to them talk about themselves for a while, or you listen to how them talk, to listen to how they talk about how life is and what they believe, it's apparent that 99% of their awareness and their consciousness exists in relationship to 1% or 2% of who they are. The consciousness is focused habitually on the bubbles on the surface of the stream. And most people just have a very abstract, very narrow relationship to themselves. It's either very superficial or totally abstract, which means even if they can talk about deep things like the soul or the spirit, and you can hear teachers talking about the Hun and the Po and the Ling and the Shen, and they're talking about them, but if you have the ears to hear it and the eyes to see it, they're talking about them completely abstractly, not from lived experiential relationship to these dimensions of the self as lived experience. So tomorrow when we in the class, the most of the morning is going to be in detail on the different dimensions of the self. So what are these dimensions of the self? Well, the soul, the conscience, the spirit, consciousness, the mind, emptiness, the authentic self. These are all dimensions of the self that most people have very little lived relationship to. And to the degree that these are abstract to us, they're going to be completely abstract in our patients too, even if we're quoting Taoist philosophy and quoting Rumi and reading Buddhist texts, but it can be all abstract. I know it can be abstract because when I finished writing my first book, 20% of that text was completely abstract to me. Like I was writing about it, but I knew that I didn't know it. So from an integral point of view, we really have to have a lived relationship to the full depth of what it means to be a human being. And we can understand integral in the sense of the recognition of oneness to recognize, you know, early in clinical practice, we can be impressed that Chinese medicine gives us great tools of differentiation. So, for instance, we do 30 or 45 minute or an hour long intake, and we're getting all this detailed information about each patient as a unique expression of the universe, what we can call a special snowflake, right? Special snowflake syndrome. Everybody's unique. We can sit, and when I take a new patient's pulse, I often take it for 20 to 40 minutes at the beginning of treatment, for the first time they come in. Depends how complex it is. Sometimes you touch the wrist and it's all there, but sometimes there's so much going on, and sometimes so many meds or multiple illnesses that it takes quite a long time to take the pulse. So everybody's unique, but, you know, we can be fascinated with that, but the truth is, after you spend like 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years in clinical practice, you realize that most people are acting out genetically programmed and culturally reinforced dramas, and the only thing that's really different are the names, the dates, and the places. And that there's really just one patient. I mean, if somebody's gallbladder and somebody else's spleen, so on one you do gallbladder 40 and the other you do spleen 3. But they're both source points and there's only one source, you see. They're just different portals in. Everything's a reflection of the same inner reality. So at the foundation of it, integral implies that as a practitioner, I'm not separate from my patient. In other words, there's one, there's not two. There's not two. There's one, not two. So I would take it the foundation of clinical efficacy as being my own integrity as a practitioner. And then my understanding is that as a practitioner, somebody who's taking money from people under the auspices of holistic healing. Holistic means that the patient comes in relatively divided and leaves increasingly whole. That patients come in with a diagnosed state of division and they move toward ever-increasing states of integrity. And from a certain perspective, Chinese medicine can be looked at as the science of integrity. So if you think about it, the only thing we diagnose is how yin and yang are coming apart. Every phrase we have, whether it's, you know, you can say, well, what if I say somebody's wood? Well, are they liver or gallbladder? And the second you say one or the other, you've made a yin-yang, internal-external distinction regarding the separation of yin and yang. If a patient had perfectly interpenetrated yin and yang, you couldn't do a diagnosis. There'd be no eight principal syndrome patterns, and the five-element circle would be perfect, and they would just flow through the whole thing, expressing everything in its own perfect time, theoretically. So all we're diagnosing is how yin and yang come apart. In Leon's pulse system, there are many phrases and many pulses that diagnose the root separation of yin and yang. And when you see that, those are some of the deepest things that have to be addressed first. But when you think about it, everything we do has to do with diagnosing separation of yin and yang and how to enhance the interpenetration of yin and yang and put yin and yang back together. And no practitioner is going to engender deeper functional relationships and more wholesome functional relationships within their patient than they actually have with the human beings they exist in relationship to in their own life. You see? So if a person's life is a mess and they have deeply dysfunctional relationships with those people, it's ridiculous to think, well, I'm going to apply this medical theory and I'm going to create this great balance of officials in my patient while my life looks like this and I have karma with this person and karma with that person, and there's deceit here and there's pretense there, you see? So from an integral point of view, the capacity to reach the patient is completely dependent on the capacity to reach ourselves. Our relationship with the patient isn't going to be more wholesome than our relationship to our own self. And in becoming a practitioner, we take on, I mean, really, if you think about it, I'm not sure if anybody's here has ever read the Bodhisattva Vow, but I would suggest that everybody does it. And the Bodhisattva Vow from Mahayana Buddhism, written by Shantideva, is just a very beautiful piece that should create, when you read it as a practitioner, it should break your heart open, eat through pride, and also create, and in that happening, create a sense of zhenqi, which is the upright, true, authentic qi, realizing that, okay, actually, I'm here because I agreed to this. This is my agreement, and the agreement is, there's a line in the Bodhisattva Vow which relates directly to integral medicine, and the line is, may I be the doctor and the medicine. The foundation of our efficacy in clinical practice is our own integrity. And integrity is not a project that is ever finished. On the one hand, in any moment, you either have integrity or you don't. And on the other hand, one could always have more, so it's developmental. And the only way to cultivate integrity is by having integrity. Only living with virtue cultivates virtue. There's no practice you can do that will give you more virtue other than acting virtuously. Do you understand? We can talk in Chinese medicine about transforming emotions into virtues. Anyone ever hear anything like that? Like transforming fear into wisdom? Mm-hmm. Transforming belligerence into benevolence? Okay. That's not how it works. You don't turn fear into the wisdom the way you turn metal into an aeroplane. Do you see? Thinking that way would be to deny a significant part of the self, which is that we're emotional beings. All the emotions are healthy. The question isn't what emotion am I having. The question is, what's my relationship to it? How identified with it am I? To what degree am I unconsciously identified with it? To what degree am I acting out of it in a way that perpetuates suffering in myself and in other people unnecessarily? So when we have a non-abstract relationship to these dimensions of our own self, we're called to take responsibility for ourselves for the sake of a greater integrity. The burden of the healer is giving one's life to an ever greater integrity, which means having to face whatever needs to be faced for the sake of having it, not for ourselves, but for everybody else. Do you see? So there, we also, in addition to all these dimensions of the self, we have all these different lines of development within the self. All these different lines of development. So, for instance, there are there's a spiritual line of development. There's an ethical line of development, musical line of development, creative line of development, the physical line of development. And all these different lines of development are developed at different levels in every human being. Some people are very developed physically, but not intellectually. Some are developed physically and intellectually, but not spiritually. It's quite possible to be very, very developed spiritually, but not ethically at all. Right? Don't we have a lot of evidence for that? Like, we don't have enough time to list the number of people, right? You can be very developed creatively and not ethically, right? Like Miles Davis, right? And Charlie Parker. Miles Davis was the trumpet player in Charlie Parker's band when Miles was like 18. And they carried on in such a debauched way that we can't even talk about it and still have me put the audio up of the of the recording. But hasn't it occurred? I remember thinking when I was a kid, how could Jimi Hendrix be channeling God through his guitar and apparently have no understanding of how to live? Right? And in terms of creativity, it's very clear, but it's true spiritually. There are any number of examples of people who could take you into non-dual awareness in just moments of talking to them and be like Krishna in Arjuna's chariot in the opening stanzas of the Bhagavad Gita and transmit a complete non-dual perspective of the universe to you in a second and then totally screw you. for their own selfish. So there are all these different lines of development. So integral means not just that we need to have a non-abstract relationship to the different dimensions of our own self for the sake of knowing our patients. So to know the patient, one has to know oneself. You're never going to know a patient to any degree better. Anything you're denying within the self, you will not see and not really take on in the patient. Isn't it clear that if you're having an affair and your patient's having an affair, what are you going to tell your patient? If you're sneaking out for cigarettes and your patient's sneaking out for cigarettes, you go, oh yeah, I totally get it, man. Do you see? So not only do we have to have a non-abstract relationship to the depth of our own selves, we have to take responsibility for our own development, and that means in every line of the self, which means facing into which lines where we're very developed, right? One person might be like incredibly empathetic and incredibly compassionate, but not very cognitively evolved. Another person can be very cognitively evolved, but not very empathetic, right? So we have all these dimensions of the self. We need to be able to see into them, and we need to be able to see in our patients where they're evolved and where they're not evolved. And the expectation is over time, a person moves from being more divided to increased states of less division, increased states of wholesomeness and integration over the course of the treatment. And that integration is across every accessible line of what it means to be a human being, with no part left behind. So the most important line of development, I think, at this point in history that's been neglected is the ethical line of development. So we might survey history, and it might impress you that for most of history, the most significant cause of misery on the planet was caused just by nature and God, right? So you lived if you got enough rain and enough sunshine, and the crops grew, and there weren't that many locusts. If you could get food, you lived. The predominant cause of illness through most of human history was external. For most of human history, humans were just animals or near animals. Right? I mean, we've only had culture, for really what we can call culture that has kept records for 4,000 years. Everything before that is prehistoric. And if you go back 50,000 years, it didn't, not that it's looking that great now, but it looked even worse then. If you're thinking, man, I really like to have been alive then and really just live in nature, your chance was like 70% dying before you were 3 months old. So with the Industrial Revolution and the dawn of the modern era in the 1800s and the arising of a middle class, there was a shift. And what the shift is that you got a class of people, the middle class, with leisure time and disposable income, who were no longer victimized by the state and by the church. And then you got central heating, and you got running water, and you got sewer systems. So there was a relative degree of cleanliness. And at that point, the main cause of human suffering shifted from external to internal, and we became the source of our own misery. The largest threat to life on the human planet now is caused by human ignorance. So it should be clear to everyone in the room, I don't think it's speculation to say that our cognitive development and the technological development that has accompanied it has far outpaced our ethical development. You think that's fair to say? Absolutely. Like, you can just look now where, is there anything in the Ten Commandments? Like, the Ten Commandments are easy, right? Don't sleep with your neighbor's wife. Okay, got that. Don't steal from your neighbor. Got that. Don't murder him. Okay, good so far. Is there anything in there that's going to tell us how to regulate nuclear power, nanotechnology, recombinant DNA, and what the effects of any of these technologies are going to be on our planet? In relationship to like recombinant DNA, people, I was in a big discussion last week on some news/science forum on the internet, and some scientists were railing at me about how can I be so ignorant as to not understand that recombinant DNA has been thoroughly vetted and is totally safe? And it's just like completely ridiculous. We have 14 billion years of dependent origination. Do you know what dependent origination is? It's a Buddhist principle. It means that everything that exists in any moment depends on everything else that exists in that moment for its existence. It all arises together. It's the theoretical foundation of Chinese medicine is dependent origination. So I'm talking to you and you have color, sound, odor, and motion, and I see your tongue and I see the way you're dressed and you lean to the right and a bird lights on the window and you say something about this, and it's all happening at once. And that whole field that's happening at once is a story, and it's all reflecting back a reality. That's synthesis. It's not linear. It's what's in the moment, what's in the moment. It's all related. Without Hitler, no Winston Churchill. Do you see? So we've had 14 to 15 billion years of development according to dependent origination, and you can't just go slamming genes into things and tell me you tested it safe. We won't know it's safe for 500 years or 5,000 years. We won't understand the implications of some of the choices that are being made now, specifically in relationship to nanotechnology and DNA. We won't understand the implications for thousands of years. It'll take that long for the evolution to play out, to understand what we've actually done. Do you see? So it seems to me that the ethical line of development is most important, which means as practitioners, our own ethical line is most important, which means that we have to develop ethically. And when I say we have to develop ethically, then the response of almost everybody in the room would be, man, what are you kidding? I'm the leading edge. When you start to look at how you individually have to respond ethically, there's a huge defense mechanism to even seeing it. Do you understand? And yet, ethics are the leading edge of clinical treatment because most people who come into us, see, conservative people go to doctors to get drugs and surgeries so they can feel better without having to change. And then open-minded people come to us for acupuncture and herbs so they can feel better without having to change. But we have to help our patients become the kind of people who don't have their problems. And that means they're going to have to reframe their entire relationship to their own self, which means start to let in dimensions of the self that have been screened from consciousness and repressed, and start to cultivate a feeling of ethical obligation to the cultivation and liberation and straightening and rectification of their own souls, which is the foundation of the spiritual practice of medicine. So I think everyone in here is interested in the spiritual practice of medicine in some way. But if you ask what spiritual is, you hear some people talk about it, it sounds like some kind of vapor that would come out of, like what we ate at Dragonfly tonight. And it had these three words. What were they? Going across the whole outside. Something like succulent, semi-sane. No, it wasn't that. It was two, and then the third word was spiritual. And I looked and I laughed, and Joanne said, we should ask them why it's spiritual. And I said, well, they serve tofu. I mean, what does spiritual mean in the context of Dragonfly Restaurant? The waitress had a skull tattooed on her arm. So we had Kali serving us. So when we start to really look at the depth of medicine, it becomes a serious affair that Western medicine will save the form of a life. It'll save the body. It's the best medicine in the world for saving the form, but we save the function. And the function of a life is the rectification of the soul. You see, so even if the body is dying and inevitably dying, far beyond what we can possibly do for it, medicine can still help rectify the soul. But we're only going to gain the power to do that with patience to the degree that we've taken that on within the self. And there's a universe of potential out there to support us doing that, but there's also a universe in a 15 billion year tradition of what we can call resistance. And then we're going to have to be the ones who overcome that. And the Bodhisattva vow contextualizes that. The Bodhisattva vow basically says, I'm going to have to face whatever I need to face to be the medicine myself. May I be the doctor and the medicine. The acupuncture needles and the pulse and the herbs and the diet and lifestyle recommendations and anything we can learn clinically about what works for what are all just a vehicle, ultimately, for the rectification of the soul. And the rectification of the soul expresses in a human being as an increased capacity for care for something greater than one's own self. So I would say, apparently, we're at a very critical time in the evolution of humanity. I go out every 5 years to do the Pacific Symposium in California. They have me out for the 10th, the 15th, the 20th, the 25th. I do those five-year ones. And I went out 10 or 12 years ago for what was the 20th or 25th. I can't remember. And I was addressing the General Assembly, which was 400 or 500 people. And I said, look, this is really serious. We probably only have 20 years left. And apparently, until things get critically grave. And apparently, I really upset some people, and I heard some girl students were crying. I offended their delicate sensibilities, and they got very upset. And some teacher threw a huge fit saying I'd never be invited back. But they did invite me back, which is... I guess they were willing to spin the roulette wheel again. But, I mean, how much time have we got? How much time do we think that we have? Do we have infinite time? In my 13th birthday was on the first Earth Day. So April 22nd, 19—my birthday is the 21st, but April 22nd, 1970, I went into Greenwich Village to see Hair, the original Broadway cast, play of Hair, and it was Earth Day. And there were millions of people in the streets and all these pictures of the world floating in space that had just come back from the rockets and the satellites and the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act was going through, and you got the endangered species list, and you got a sense that, okay, everybody knows about all this stuff, they're going to take care of it. Well, they didn't. And now things are pretty grim. They're not looking better, they're looking worse, right? So to me, that only increases my sense of responsibility for how serious the opportunity of this medicine is. So we all went into this medicine because we had some kind of idea and self-image and probably a significant degree of genuine inspiration about really, really wanting to make a difference. But so I'm just saying all this by way of encouragement of getting in touch with that and taking it deadly serious, which means one really has to face oneself, which means if one gets uncomfortable in school with being challenged or uncomfortable in the clinic because one is being challenged or uncomfortable in whatever spiritual growth work one is doing, one has to double down and take it 1,000 times more seriously. Because time is really of the essence. I only went into this medicine because I thought it would be... I recognized it very early on. I started reading the Tao Te Ching and Lao Tzu and all the Chinese philosophers when I was 13. And I recognized Chinese medicine very early on. I said, this model of the five elements directly ties human health into the cycles of nature. And that's exactly what the West needs. And this is the perfect vehicle for changing culture. So I've never been interested in treating the individual primarily. When an individual is, what difference does it make treating Mrs. Jones for carpal tunnel syndrome when her species is imminently threatened with extinction? So I didn't say it didn't make a difference. I said, what difference does it make? And to me, as far as I can see, the external symptom is just a sign, and the external symptom is an external symptom, and it's a sign of a deeper imbalance, and if we take that imbalance deeply enough, it goes to the state and stage development of that human soul, which isn't separate from the state and stage development of any human soul. The individual is culture. When we're treating the individual, that person in our room is a portal into the one human being. And my capacity to reach that one human being is entirely dependent on my own willingness to face my own self. So that's integral. So now we're going to move on, because just because we have limited time, we're going to talk about evolution. So Sri Aurobindo had this profound awakening that the Eastern teachings only made sense in the context of evolution. And he wrote many beautiful things, but my favorite book, which is actually, it's a small book, but it's abstracted from a huge book, I think from his text, that is called The Life Divine. Or it might be called, or From the Future Evolution of Man. I can't remember which. But he has a book called The Problem of Rebirth, in which he interprets karma and reincarnation in an evolutionary context, saying evolution is the only context in which rebirth actually makes sense. Otherwise all it means is God's a sadist. And we're going on forever getting bodies, just recapitulating this suffering over and over and over again for no reason whatsoever. The point is to take it all somewhere, you see? So if you look at all the traditions, the thing that characterizes all the great pre-modern traditions, so when I say that, I mean Taoism, Confucianism, Buddhism, Vedanta, Christianity, the Hebrew tradition, Sufi tradition, and Muslim tradition, and any of the traditions you can think of, they're all characterized as having an end state. You see? In the Eastern traditions, you get enlightened and you don't have to come back. And in the Western traditions, you die and you go to heaven and you get to have tea and ice cream with everyone you like during life for eternity. Walk around on fluffy clouds. You see, if there is a God who lives up there on those clouds, it's not between Albany and Gainesville. Unless he has my travel schedule and is constantly hiding. But I had a window seat today and there was nobody up there. So at least that mythic God we can be suspect of. We could have a year-long course on evolution and the implications of it for medicine, but we can sum it up as this. An evolutionary context merely means development of the self with no part left behind, without end. At least without any conceivable end. That's not to say there won't be an end. I don't freaking know. It would be pretentious to say one knows. But from an evolutionary perspective, the trajectory is just infinite. All the way down, all the way up, forever. Lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. So the original Bodhisattva vow basically said, I will put off my own enlightenment until I've worked for and achieved the enlightenment of all sentient beings. But this just adds forever. See, in Theravada Buddhism, the Buddha's Buddhism, people were just like walking away from their families and walking away from culture and going and meditating in caves and getting enlightened and dying. And so there was a social impetus to stop that and reframe the whole spiritual endeavor to be one of giving. Selfless service, one of giving. So that's the contribution of Mahayana Buddhism. But then the punchline was, I'll put off my enlightenment till everyone else is enlightened. And then when they are, I'll turn out the lights and get out of here. Because the first noble truth is life is suffering. So I don't know anyone who's lived any appreciable amount of time who hasn't suffered. But having grown, being white in America in the 20th century and growing up in Roslyn, Long Island, I've definitely suffered. Everybody's suffering is as real to them as anybody else's suffering. But let me tell you, life hasn't been too tough. It's hard for me to relate to life primarily as suffering. It's easy if you go to India and step off the plane to be in Delhi for 2 minutes and get that life is suffering and to understand where the Buddha is coming from. The Buddha lived in a culture where 99% of the people lived in disease, in dirt. So it's in with worms. They died some terrible Jwayin death, vomiting worms. Horrible. I have patients still who go to India and they come back and they're pulling 6-inch worms out of themselves. Fortunately, I know how to take care of that. But it's easy to understand from that perspective. But from our perspective, the people in this room, we're the when you talk about politically, you talk about the 1%. We're the 1% of all the fortunate people who have ever lived. So then the question is, if we have the best nutrition, which we do, of anybody who's ever lived, why are we taking all the nutritional supplements? And if we have the most political, social, economic freedom of anybody who's ever lived, which we actually do, we have a degree of freedom. Everyone is in this room tonight because they want to be. The Pharaoh didn't have that, couldn't make choices like that. The Pharaoh would get up in the morning, what do you want to do today, dear? Let's watch them build the pyramids. Like on a good day, he got grapes. We have more freedom. The outcome of our lives, who we are right now in this moment, in this room, is more the product of choices we freely made than any other people who've ever lived. So I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, and we would want that to be true for everybody. It's only true for what, 15% of the planet? 20%, 15, 20% of the planet have the capacity to decide where they're going to live and who they're going to marry and what they're going to study. And if your major doesn't work out, you just go back to school. And if your marriage doesn't work out, you just get divorced and start another family. And if you don't like your house, you sell it and buy another house, right? So we're really blessed. So it's really hard to relate to this idea that life is suffering. So for us, life isn't suffering. Life, and we've chosen to be healers, life should be about alleviating the suffering of others. And we have to recognize that the suffering of others isn't just that their back hurts and their shoulder hurts, but that there's a deep, deep level of existential suffering, and that suffering is and that's based on the distortion of the soul. It's based on ignorance of who and what we really are and why we're here. So the three questions of spiritual import is, who am I, why am I here, how shall I live? Everybody's concerned with how shall I live. So they come in, do you think I should go to this school? Do you think I should go to that school? Should I stay in my marriage? Should I leave my marriage? Should I have kids or shouldn't I have kids? Should I have another kid or not have a kid? Should I get a dog or should I have a cat? Should I have rice or should I have pasta? So that's all how shall I live. Everyone wants to cut to the chase. But you can't actually meaningfully answer that until you know who you are. So the thing about Chinese medicine is it works potentially with the authentic self, the true self, the soul, the spirit. All the syndrome patterns are just physiological metaphors for embodied ignorance when looked at from a spiritual point of view. All stagnations are just physiological metaphors for a place that attention is contracted into the personal away from the universal, from a spiritual point of view. So, to sum again, evolution just means development in every dimension of the self without end. Okay, so first we have to know who we are, which means wake up to the self beyond the superficial relationship we have to it, take responsibility for it, and then set about actually developing it. And there's a recognition that the assumption is we're never going to get to a place where we can say, there, I did it. The body's going to drop, wake up in another body, and then you're good to go. And you're just taking that soul further and further, but there's no end to it. We can understand historically why we'd have to postulate an end, because life was terrible, terrible suffering. But if I drop dead tonight, I'm going to miss next month's issue of Vintage Guitar magazine. Right? So when you awaken to an evolutionary context, you actually feel this passion. Last time I had lunch with Leon, which was two summers ago, he didn't make it up last summer, but the last lunch we had, he was 91, he's 92 now. And he said, Lonnie, I've done half my life's work. So when you're awakened to an evolutionary context, there's this, you just see yourself as a vehicle and you just want to go. Right? You just want to do it. But in order to do it in a wholesome way, that has to be rooted in, wholesome actions have to come from a soul which is reasonably straight. And reasonably straight means having no radical, fundamental, underlying contradictions. And the ego exists in denial of those contradictions because they contradict self-image and it's too painful for most of us to see. So we'll be talking about that substantially tomorrow. This weekend I'm talking about trauma and treating trauma with Chinese medicine, and we're going to spend the morning asking the question and talking about who was injured. If we're talking about treating trauma, who was injured? That's very important to know. So the last dimension here is the spiritual dimension. I talked about integral. Integral means every dimension of the self with no part behind. Evolution means development in every part of the self with no part left behind forever. And then we want to talk about spirit. We can say that there are three realms. The first through fourth chakra are the gross realm. That's waking life. We'll talk more about this over the weekend. That's waking life. Waking life is the apparent reality. I'm me, you're you, you're here, you're there, I'm here. This is a pen, this is a cup, this is a recorder, this is a table. Everything is apparently solid and it is what it is. That's the body and it's the cognitive mind that orients us in time and space. Beyond waking life are the fifth and sixth chakra. That's the subtle realm. That's dream time. And as you know, in dream time completely deconstructs waking life. In your dreams, a cup isn't just a cup. A table isn't just a table. A person you see isn't just the person you see. When you look at your life from dream time, your life is completely deconstructed, and all you see is a flow of symbols and metaphors. Nothing is solid. It's all just symbolic and metaphorical. Chinese medicine, in its highest capacity, works up to the sixth level chakra. The point names and the herb names are all archetypes. They're all symbols. The seventh and eighth chakra is your deepest sleep. If you look at your waking life from the perspective of your dreams, it's completely deconstructed. Nothing solid, nothing's real. But from the perspective of your deepest sleep, where are your dreams? They don't exist. Not from the perspective of your deepest sleep. From the perspective of your deepest sleep, where are you? So From nothing comes something, and that something is the body. From the body comes the mind, congruent with the emergence of language. From the mind comes the ego. That gets you to fourth chakra. As you step over into fifth and sixth chakra, into the subtle realm, you're in the realm of the soul. So from the ego comes the soul. That means, practically speaking, when you've been egoic enough that you've caused yourself suffering and other people suffering, and you can't bear it anymore, you start to develop empathy and compassion, which means you start to care about something greater than your own self, which means you start to have intuitions of the soul. And from the soul comes the spirit. So the seventh and eighth chakra, the realm of spirit. So spirit has two directions, transcendence and immanence. Spirit is freedom, and there are two types of freedom. Eastern freedom is freedom from, and the Western freedom is freedom to. The Eastern freedom is freedom from. Freedom from is transcendence. The universe doesn't exist. Culture doesn't exist. The earth doesn't exist. My body doesn't exist. Ramana Maharshi became so enlightened and so enthralled with enlightenment that when the villagers went to the cave he was meditating in, bugs were just on him and rats were eating his flesh. The little kids in town would go and throw rocks to see if they could get him to come out of meditation. He was just wasting away, starving to death. And he only agreed to eat if they put the food in his mouth. You see? So there's a and you can see that in that ascetic kind of world renunciation, I'm leaving the world in all the pre-modern traditions where you go become a nun or a monk, and you take a vow of celibacy, and you leave the world, and you leave culture, and you turn your back on your family, and you become nothing, and you become no one. And you just spend all your time contemplating God, you see? And you can tell that they've done that in Asia for the last 10,000 years. As soon as you get off the airplane and see the roads, there's like no infrastructure. I mean, in some cities now there are, but, you know, go 10 miles, 20 miles outside of Delhi into the countryside, and it's just, everything is crumbling. Just people sitting in dirt, in structures with no roofs, and the holes have the roads have potholes so big in them that the car could disappear into them, never to be, you know, 20-foot potholes in the middle of highways. So you can see that concrete reality to them was an illusion. And on the other hand, in the West, the direction hasn't been a return, a transcendence of life. It's immanence. It's go, 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 go. And you can see how distorted that's become as we've repressed the unconscious, repressed the body, repressed the feminine, repressed nature. And the biosphere is coming apart. So, spirit has two directions. Return to source. It's pushing deeper, 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 deeper. Carl Jung said, you don't become enlightened by imagining spires of light. You become enlightened by illuminating the darkness. The way the soul is rectified, you know, a lot of the traditions just seek to disembody light from the vehicle. So in Buddhism, you have this theoretical endpoint of the rainbow body, where the practitioner is like one of the drummers in Spinal Tap. You remember the drummers just kept bursting into flames and disappearing, and someone else would run out with sticks and finish the song. And if you look at the Christian traditions and the Buddhist and Taoist traditions, they all seek to disembody light, right? The Holy Ghost. From the body, to raise light from the body. And that all exists under the auspices of patriarchy, because the body also stands for nature, the unconscious, and the feminine. And this idea of raising light out of it is masculine yang to get rid of the body, because only the body can cast a shadow. And therefore the body is sin and the body is evil. And nature is evil. And women are evil, so we have to cover them with sheets. Right? So authentic spirit has two directions. A return, and what I'm talking about the last few minutes here is the corruption in the traditions of this essential fact, that spirit itself, when it's liberated, instantly returns towards source, but it also bursts forward to greater and greater manifestations. So when we talk about repression and denial, the ego exists as the force of repression and denial. We'll talk about this tomorrow. But we don't just repress our pasts, we repress our potential future. Repression is never selective. So to the degree that any individual is repressing any dimension of themselves they won't face from their own past because it's too painful to really embrace either what's happened to them or what they've done to another, to take full responsibility for it. To the degree that an individual represses the past, it is impossible for them to fully manifest their future potential. Because repression isn't selective. To repress the past is to repress the future. What spirit is endeavoring to do is illuminate the darkness, the depth, return to and discover itself as emptiness. Emptiness being the dimension of the self where nothing ever happened, nothing is happening, nothing ever will happen. So it has nothing to overcome. And simultaneously, the mirror image expression of spirit is the authentic self, which is just the compulsion to respond to what's ever happening right now in a way that makes it better. For the self to become the motivating force for the emergence of spirit in creation toward the true, the good, the beautiful. And we're only going to be able to liberate spirit for the sake of producing the true, the good, and the beautiful within a patient to the degree that we've given ourselves to that in our own life. So to me, that brings integral, which means no dimension of the self left behind, a living non-abstract relationship to the self, evolutionary together, which means we're going to endeavor to take on the responsibility of development in that self for eternity with no end. No holidays, no vacations. Get up every day, you want to go to sleep at night better than when you got up, improved in some way, seeing something deeper, seeing something higher, right? And it's that orientation which, if we give ourselves to it, will make us uncynical about the potential for a human being to develop in the face of resistance, to the degree we have some meaningful measure of victory over our own force of inertia and denial, will become uncynical. And I would say that it's our job to have an integrity that's uncommon, one that inspires in patients their capacity to believe they could have it too. In other words, we need to be the kind of human beings as healthcare practitioners who make it impossible for patients to become cynical about their own development in the face of their experience with us. And then spiritual means that because we've taken ourselves on and we're not just... It's not just that we've developed, but we're developing. And it's not just that we're developing, but we're oriented toward development. That the soul is rectified. And as the soul is rectified, conscience is restored. And the soul acts to be a more perfect mirror for the transmission of spirit in the world as a force of momentum toward the emergence of the true, the good, the beautiful. And if we're going to do it, we better do it quick. So I'm optimistic. I'm an idealist, but I'm also practical. So I'm always interested in the place that practicality meets idealism. And I've got to believe we still have time, but how much time do we have? So to me, time is of the essence, and it's imperative for us to get very, very, very serious about this. Which means if we're doing spiritual practices, to be really honest with ourselves why we're doing them and what our goal is. And to take that very, very seriously. I find that where I come into conflict with my students and my patients is that I tend to take them much more seriously than they take themselves. Most people don't take themselves that seriously. So the thing is, in terms of the transformation of Jing, when you get to the age of 50, if you've been paying any attention at all, you can't harbor the illusion that you've got infinite time left to get to the important things in life. So if someone's 17 or 20 or 30, you can forgive them for being casual and frivolous. If you meet someone in their 20s or 30s who's really serious about the important stuff, it's so impressive. It's humbling. And if I look back on, you know, what an idiot I was, how ignorant I was and how much karma I was causing when I was in my 20s and 30s. It's inspiring. But it's pretty rare in any event to meet such a person, and certainly by the time you're 50, you know enough people who aren't here anymore, who they thought they had enough time to get to the important things. And so you don't really want to wait until life takes you out at the knees to develop some humility. It's good to... I can't think of a single profession that could make a person more humble than trying to mitigate human suffering by sticking needles in people. So we're all in the right place for that. And yeah, I think we did it. So okay, so that's... I guess I said what I had to say. I always sit here thinking, what the hell am I going to say for an hour and a half? But, okay, so that was about an hour and 10, and I'm happy to take... I think we're here till 9, so the rest of the lecture will be the next 2 days, but I'll answer questions until the last person goes home, and then I'll turn out the lights, just like in Mahayana. So any questions about anything I said, or personal questions, how you related to what I said, or anything? There's a nice feel, there's a really nice field in the room. Like if you just tune in. There's like a deep meditative current, like if you just pay attention for a second. There's like a strong meditative current in the room. Okay, yes?
I'm trying to think of the question, but I guess it's interesting for me to be here because just in my own personal life right now, I'm working on, like you were talking about, in Western culture right now, it's this go-go-go, and I'm sure you feel that at times. How do you...
I felt that every day since 1975.
So this idea of just striving, how do you reconcile that with your ideas of, I guess, in a way, the way that I perceive it is, it's a lot of self-reliance, in a way.
Self-reliance?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you mean to say? I mean, self-reliance seems like a good thing. Like, to have a healthy ego, one has to be self-reliant as a foundation for transcendence.
Mm-hmm. I guess... Yeah, that might be where I might...
Is what you're trying to say that it seems like we're going and not reflecting enough, and there's too much yang and not enough yin?
No, I think there's this, like, duality of wanting to be ethical, striving to be the best, trying to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
But then there's this idea of Taoism or even other philosophies of different religions where you actually want to allow what happens to happen, and not everything is in our own personal control.
Well, I mean, there are a few things to say about that. So definitely not everything's in our own personal control. Taoism is all about merging with, and merging with is deep, it's profound, probably a foundational and necessary step for going any further. But there's a step beyond merging with. So if, from a non-dual perspective, if there's only one, then it's not enough to just throw yourself in the river and let it take you. That's not the same as co-creation. So there's a step beyond merging, which is once I've seen that there's one, and I am that one, then I'm responsible for the outcome. Even if no one else will do it, I have to give it everything, because I said yes to being here. And if I said yes to being here, then I can't just wait for the white guy on the cloud with the beard to do it. See, there are all these pre-modern ideas of one way or another, regardless of the language used, it all comes to Big Daddy out there, Big Daddy Tao or Big Daddy God taking care of everything. And I would say the step beyond merging with is getting in the driver's seat and taking responsibility for the process of evolution. So, in a certain sense, so Lao Tzu begins the Tao Te Ching telling us the name that can be named is not the eternal name. And in that we can deduce there's an implication that language, that naming, that the human mind creates reality. And that language can't ever quite capture the ultimate reality that's behind it. And that is true from a certain perspective, but from another perspective, we could say that language is the most evolved capacity the universe has manifested to date. Like if I had come in here and just not talked, it would have been not great. So it's through language that we can recognize that what's speaking is the same thing that's listening. And then when we realize that, we can get in the driver's seat and start taking responsibility. So here's the thing. Is the Tao or is God, that's the Western, is the Tao or is God creating the next vehicle for consciousness? Or are we doing it? We're doing it, right? In laboratories with nanotechnology and genetic engineering, we're creating the next vehicle for the evolution of consciousness. Do we have the ethical development to do that properly? No, we're proceeding really unconsciously. So as long as we're doing it, it should be a conscious process, as much as possible, not an unconscious process. But we are already doing it. Anyway, so the questions you bring up, I think are good questions that are totally open for discussion. There is a mystery at the heart of everything. So a sign of maturity is the understanding that there's a mystery at the heart of everything and that you are the portal to that mystery. You're not separate from that mystery and you have some measure of free will and access to its one consciousness. So I think we just have to sit with all of that and contemplate it. Yes, madam, did you have a question?
I was going to ask in response that we're creating all tech, or we're creating it in nanotech, we're creating the next vehicle. But are there people that are not necessarily doing nanotechnology on the other extreme? They're in the mountains meditating or contemplating, and
No, I think so aren't they contributing to in some way?
Yes.
Sure. But on the other hand, they've had the last 4,000 years and here we are. And if all human beings just started meditating and got radically enlightened to only emptiness, which is freedom from. So if all human beings tomorrow had if all of humanity had a radical awakening to the Buddha's awakening, we'd all just sit and watch the polar ice caps float down into Tampa Harbor. It's all an illusion, baby. So it's an important and an essential perspective, but it's just a perspective.
Yes.
It's not the only perspective, and it has its weaknesses and it has its strengths. And the weaknesses are apparent if you've ever been in Asia, as are its strengths. But the traditions just had 4,000 years, and here we are.
And so what? Now we contemplate? We contemplate ourselves, and to do that, we practice a medicine and try to help other people? Contemplate themselves?
Not exactly. I think we wake up to who and what we really are through authentic spiritual practice and intellectual inquiry. Contemplation is one practice. So to me, there's meditation, there's contemplation, there's thought. Meditation is the contemplation of nothing. Contemplation is meditating on something. And then thought is just, here are all the reasons for, here are all the reasons against. Do you see? And they're all important. They're all important dimensions. But, you know, I think we wake up by wanting to wake up. So we just start to get very serious about really waking up. So I've made the declaration. I made the declaration, which you may or may not agree with, or it may or may not be your experience, that most people have a very, very superficial relationship to their own selves and a very abstract relationship to their own selves and consequently a very abstract relationship to this medicine because this is a medicine which is a science of the self. Do you understand? So I've said most people have a very superficial relationship to their own self. So you would have to ask yourself, well, in your experience, to what degree is that true? How well do you know yourself? I talked about conscience and soul and spirit and the authentic self and emptiness as an ego, for instance, as dimensions of the self. And then you would need to ask yourself, well, how well do I really know those dimensions? How clear are the distinctions between them for me? And then you'd have to get very interested in those things. And of course, at first you'd want to study those things, and at first you'd be reading about them, and your understanding would be cognitive, but at some point you might get really frustrated. So what happened for me was I finished my first book. My second book was about to come out. I hadn't talked to Leon for 10 years, and we were both going to be teaching at the same conference down in New Jersey. Oddly enough, there was a Taoist conference every year in the Meadowlands. I don't know what real Taoists would ever think. We're having a conference. Let's have it in Jersey in the Meadowlands, off some highway in some crappy hotel with windows that don't open. But we got together there and we hadn't actually talked for 10 years. So we stopped talking around 95 or 6. So this was 2005 or 6. We got together and I bought him dinner and we had a really nice conversation and sort of became friends again. And then as we were leaving, Leon asked me about the next book I was going to write. And I said, I'm not going to write another book. And he said, I know you. You're going to write another book. And he was right, because I am writing another book. But I said, no, you know, I said, I've accomplished enough in that regard. There's a dimension of my teaching that's totally abstract to me. And at that point, my heart was kind of broken about it. So I got deadly, deadly serious about it not being abstract anymore. And as soon as I was, I remember waving goodbye to Leon in the hotel and walking out to my car and thinking, this is it, man, I'm going to do this. And it all happened within 2 weeks, as soon as you get serious about it. Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment.
Yeah.
Just as far as the repression comment, how we repress the past and that impedes on our future
potential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That has been my experience up to this point. And so I'm really excited to get to be here because it's kind of, I'm not a student currently, but that's what I'm seeking out. And so it's exciting to realize and to hear you say that.
Well, the unconscious isn't just a one big dark bag. So the unconscious has a historical dimension to it. And we'll talk about this tomorrow. We'll divide the unconscious. Are you in the lecture tomorrow? Okay. So the unconscious has a historical dimension, but it also... A very significant part of the unconscious is our future self calling. So our future self is always calling, and that's one of the most significant things that people repress. You find out as a practitioner, what we're learning to diagnose in people is essentially their unfulfilled potential, their imminent but as unyet realized potential, where it's pushing and what's in its way. And then we name what's in its way congealed blood or stagnant qi or damp or cotton quality on the pulse or whatever you want. We give it some physiological abstract term so we can remove ourselves a dimension from it. But all of the terms in the medicine are really just diagnosing where life is not moving into and what's in its way and how to get what's not true self and what's not alive, what's death, out of the way of what's life, so life can take over. That's essentially what we're doing. And you know, it's our future which is the source of imminent potential in us, not the past. The past is dead. The past is just a layer in some gorge. It's the future where everything's possible. Good. Okay, anybody else? Yes.
Struggle is about doing, acting versus accepting and non-doing, like the Taoist and Oriental philosophy. I share that struggle, and I think it can be answered by your three questions, like why are we here, who we are, how to live.
Right.
So I feel that maybe can answer the question of, for the important stuff, for things that, why are we, related to why are we here, those things need action and need go sometimes. And then the rest of it, we can,
well, I was saying that the Asian freedom is freedom from, which is just being, wu wei, not doing, letting it all happen. And the Western freedom is freedom too. And we're at a stage in development where we can actually realize Buddha's awakening and Jesus' awakening, and there's an awakening beyond that. In the very same way, we're at a place in history, which is interesting, where we're realizing in the leading edge of culture, aren't we realizing that gender is a construct? We realized 40 years ago that race was a construct, right? That there's no such thing as race. It's just a totally made-up construct. Now we're recognizing that gender is a construct. So as human, you know, Freud recognized, you know, Freud, there are some problems with Freud, but the guy was, you know, beyond a genius. And the work that Carl Jung did and then Jung's students, Eric Neumann and some of the other Jungian analysts, I mean, this stuff is just... And great geniuses. So anyway, I mean, the fundamental realization is that this binary definition of gender is really a rather evolutionarily immature recognition, and that ultimately gender exists on a broad continuum, It's just a construct, like race is a construct, and that as human beings evolve, women take responsibility for what we would call the masculine within them. Men take responsibility for the feminine within them, but we're not looking for men who are more like women or women who are looking more like men, and we're not all moving towards some kind of androgyny. There's actually a third position beyond the dichotomy of male-female. Do you understand? And there's an enlightenment beyond Buddha and Jesus, beyond just Buddha's enlightenment or Jesus' enlightenment. There's actually a synthesis of the two and then a whole springing off point too. So contemplation, meditation are important. I mean, I did a lot of meditation for 13 years. I did 1 to 2 hours a day, and I used to do 12-hour sits at a time without moving. And I would do 10 days from 4 in the morning till 11 at night, at least once a year. And I would used to do 24 hours, and I'd do 3 hours meditating, 15 minutes off for 24 hours, and this sort of thing. So, you know, that realization is very important, but let's face it, I mean, if the goal is to continue the project of evolution, and to be able to contribute, and we want to be able to, you know, it is true, I'm quite sure that if human beings die and all life on the planet dies, probably all life won't die. Another billion years will go by and there'll be some hybrid nanotechnological DNA hybrid thing that grows out of the dead ocean from Fukushima that maybe is willing to take more responsibility for itself than we are.
Contemplating its existence.
I know. I think it'll just take more responsibility for itself than we are. So waking up to the Buddha's awakening of contemplation and the Taoist awakening of merging with is all essential and beautiful, but it's all partial. It's not enough. Yes?
Hi. If I may ask you a sort of somewhat personal question, going back to what you were talking about after seeing Leon at the hotel, like you referenced meditating kind of hardcore for 13 years, but then there was something that you did in a 2-week period where you said you got really serious.
Well, I had gotten deadly serious, and then I said it took about 2 weeks so that my life's work wasn't abstract to me anymore and I could see it all in my own experience.
Okay,
so now when I lecture, for instance, when I'm teaching now, there's not a word I said that's abstract to me. I'm just speaking from my own experience.
So my question to you is, okay, so I guess that's what the result was. My question is, what did you do?
I let go.
To get serious.
I let go.
Did you stay?
I let go unconditionally.
And how did you, is there a, I'm just curious.
I can't do it for you.
No, I know. I'm curious about people's stories for that.
Yeah, I just let go. I've been a spiritual seeker since I was 13, so if this was about 2005, that's 12 years ago. I'm doing math here. It's not my strong point. So I was about 40. I was 42 at the time, or about 42 or 3. And I just was in a meditation. I was meditating like I had learned in 1972. I sat to meditate. I hated meditating from 1972 until that day in 2001 or 2, whenever it was. Like I would sit there and torture myself, you know? I hated it. So if I did 20 minutes, I'd feel like, God, I did 20 minutes. And then I finally just sat down one night and said, okay, I'm going to do it, and I just let go unconditionally and saw what I needed to see in a second so that it wasn't abstract anymore. Okay.
Question. When you say you just let go and you saw what you needed to see, does that mean then just the words just flew and then it just came and came and came until you were done?
Okay. We've met before, haven't we?
I don't know.
You look familiar.
Steve Littler from Gainesville, Florida?
I don't know.
Okay.
Did you go to this school?
No.
You've never come to one of my lectures?
No. Well, I've been in for a couple of treatments, but that's it.
Then I guess we haven't met.
Okay.
Must be that other tall guy with a white cap. Okay, I didn't understand your question exactly. Anyway, not to spend too much time on that, it doesn't really matter.
Well, what I'm saying is that when I go to write, you know, it's hard to get out, and then after a while it's just come, and after you get a couple pages, it comes more and more. And you say, you just, you know, obviously I'm holding back or something, you know, and then finally it breaks through a little bit and more comes. But you came through in 2 weeks.
No, I didn't come through in 2 weeks. I mean, for all I know, there were 40 trillion lifetimes, and I mean, the thing is that essentially one comes to a point in life where one is so sick of oneself that one can't bear to create karma and suffering anymore, and discovers some humility and gets serious, just gets fundamentally serious. So in the talk tonight, I've just tried to, you know, I'm just talking about my experience in the medicine and the perspectives, the integral evolutionary spiritual perspectives, which are just language that I use for talking about my experience. But I think we just come to a point in life. And I mean, you know, medicine sucks as a business if you're not about service. It's just going to be painful and tedious to do. You have to really, 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 really care. And that care is born of having taken oneself on and developing some compassion and some empathy, because you recognize in stepping beyond ego and in recognizing your own soul and in getting a measure of victory into facing what one has done to one's own soul and the consequences of one's actions toward it, one gets some humility and starts to realize the consequences of one's actions toward everybody else's, and then developing authentic compassion, because you recognize everybody is a soul, this one soul struggling to express, and that there's really no separation. And so then you become willing to really do the hard work that it takes. And, you know, in meditation, for instance, the goal is to unconditionally let go. But I've treated Buddhist lineage holders who run big sects, who have meditated 2 hours a day for 30 years, and they haven't let go. They come to get off Prozac and anti-anxiety meds and sleeping pills after 30 years of meditation with thousands of followers. So, okay, any other questions? We have a little more time. Yeah.
Can you talk to empowering your patients? I'm an RN who's going to acupuncture school, but over the years I found it very hard to empower patients, even in the Western medicine side, much less in the side where you really need to take some responsibility to row that boat across the other side of the channel. So can you talk to empowering your patients?
Well, it's kind of a general question. I mean, the context which you've been working in, the deck is completely stacked against empowering patients, which is probably why you've... I mean, it's hard to empower somebody when they have to wait 2.5 months for a 15-minute visit. And then you see them 2.5 hours later and they've been in your waiting room reading Newsweek magazine and run into the room. So presumably you found some lack there, and this medicine, your practice is going to look exactly the way you want it to look, so you'll have as much time as you need to take to do that. And everything we do from a certain perspective has to do with empowering patients, but that really goes beyond the sort of like Jack LaLanne, Tony Robbins, kind of like, yeah, you can do it, kind of like, you know, est sort of forum kind of go kind of thing, like cheerleading kind of thing, and like Amway.
No, not cheerleading, just getting people to accept responsibility for...
No, well, but it's important to understand there are two people sitting in that chair. And one of them is there because their soul has come into contact with yours for reasons, mysterious reasons. Right, so it's not trivial that that patient is sitting in your room, so there's an opportunity. And they've took the time to find out about you, make an appointment, keep appointment. They're willing to spend money, right? And they want to get better. And then there's another self there that stands in opposition, and its only impetus is to maintain the status quo. So there's a huge infinite momentum of 14 billion year trajectory of evolution behind that soul. And the soul is calling to be heard and freed, rectified for the sake of bringing spirit into the world. And then there's 15 billion years of resistance. And the patient is genetically programmed and culturally reinforced to know themselves relatively more as the resistance than they are to know themselves as the impulse to evolve. And you can say anything you want to say, and you can read philosophy and take human motivation courses, but it's who you are that's going to speak louder. It's your own integrity, and it's the momentum of your own developing integrity that's going to be the inspirational force to the patient, that the needles and the herbs are going to be the vehicle for, more so than just saying this or saying that or knowing this technique or telling them to take more, you know, a cup of turmeric and ginger every night, or, you know, all that kind of information is good, but technique and information only serve who you are. Technique and information and knowledge are vehicles for the emergence of greater integrity, and you have to be a living example of that integrity. I go different places to teach, and I was hired by a woman to teach, and I went to her school to teach, and every break the entire time I was teaching, she was standing by the door smoking a cigarette in front of all of her students. And I just had eventually say, you know, there's the life impulse and the death impulse, and it is not the life impulse that's smoking cigarettes on breaks in front of all your patients and students. Anyway, that didn't go over well. Yeah. Yeah, so we're, you know, it's more important than what we say and what we do is who we are. I have literally treated gallbladder 40 on a patient, gone out of the room, come back in only to find out that I had put in spleen 5. And had the patient come back and tell me that the treatment was completely life-changing. And I've done the most elegant, brilliant, pioneering work in Chinese medicine and had the patient come back and say, huh, nothing happened. Totally impressed with the symmetry of my needle placement. So, but the thing is, but you're always you. So some people, I get critiques and say, it sounds like what you're talking about is like a religious cult, and you should leave all of that stuff outside the treatment room. Well, see, the thing is, even if that's what you're doing, you're still bringing your philosophy of life into the treatment room by leaving everything outside that you think is not relevant. People think, my treatment room is a sacred space and I leave all my stuff outside it. No, you don't. It's impossible. There's only one of you. It's like when I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead when I was a kid, and it said, when you die, go toward the white light. And I thought, God, what a relief. I got it. This is like a get-out-of-jail-free card. I can do anything I want, and when I die, I go toward the white light. How simple can that be? I remember, like, when I was 14 or 15, really sighing and thinking, God, I got it. Okay, I'm just going to go. The thing is, when you die, you're going to keep doing exactly what you've been doing for the same reasons that you're doing it now. And you're not going to go toward the white light then to any degree more than you're going toward it right now. And your reason for not going toward it then is going to be the exact same reason you're not right now. And that's the only way it works. That's just physics. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm reasonably certain of that. I'm as certain as I can be without actually being dead and speaking from that place. Although, I do suspect we are already dead and in that place. From a certain point of view, right? Certainly from the perspective of Tibetan Buddhism and from the perspective of the American Indian tradition and like Amazonian medicine. From the perspective of Amazonian medicine, we're all dead. So it's all just a question of perspectives. Any other questions? Yes.
So I feel like we've been sort of dancing around this part of this question, and you speak about how our work that we do with our patients is only as deep as the work that we've done for ourselves, and then you speak of these three, the integral, the evolutionary, yes, and the spiritual. And I feel like it gets kind of lost in the longness of purity of the ideal, an ideal.
It's good to be inspired by ideals.
I'm really interested in the intersection of, I believe there is beauty sort of in the large intestine aspect. Like I'm coming at this from the metal, that there is beauty in our messiness. There is beauty in the places where we fall down, and there is, and that the, and so where is that intersection of when we're sitting with our patients, we're doing our own work, we're encouraging them to do their work, and we have the humility of saying, I know I'm not there yet. I don't know where the question is in that, but there is sort of one pushing its way through, and so I'm...
Well, and in what I said, mm-hmm, I already answered the question.
Yeah,
so how did I do that? So in what I said already, so how did I define integral?
The all, every aspect.
With no part of the self left behind.
Calling on that is...
Well, a view of the human being with no part of the self left behind,
yeah,
which would that doesn't accept the large intestine.
So you say you've been going.
So we talked about shadow.
Yeah.
So when you talk about the large intestine and its contents, what you're talking about is the shadow, very really the shadow, which is the crap that we bury beneath the diaphragm in the depths of self in the basement that we'd rather not see. And I spent a lot of time I quoted Jung about the importance of that we don't create enlightenment by imagining spirals of light. We bring light to the darkness, which directly addresses exactly what you're saying.
And
right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The compassion that we bring with ourselves and our humanness and our messiness is part of that whole package.
Well, I talked about the fallacy of the traditions that seek to disincarnate light from the body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're dancing around. I'm still there's something in the center that I'm still dancing around. But thank you.
Okay, I don't think we disagree.
No, yeah.
But we just have to make a distinction between wallowing in the sewer and being aware of what's down there. So I would just prefer to be out of it and to bring the perspective of being out of it to it rather than remaining in it and embedded within it. So we can bring a top-down perspective to it without denying it, without repressing it. But certainly we don't want to torture ourselves for being human. We want to accept, but we also don't want to be unnecessarily forgiving of things we know that in reality we should have changed years ago and just haven't acted on. How forgiving do we want to be of creating the same karma over and over and over and over and over and over again? So I think there's a fine and a delicate line to walk. So when we talk about acceptance, what is it that we're accepting? Mm-hmm. My wife and I sent our kids to a Sufi school for preschool, the Pir Velat school. Pir Velat Khan, his school is just a few miles from our house, this community he founded. So we sent them to that school. And we got a call from the principal of the school And he said, your kids are so unique and so different from every other kid in school. We want you and your wife to come in and meet with the teachers to talk about how you're raising your children. And so at the outset, one of the teachers said to me, she said, and to my wife, Emily, she said, how do you get a bunch of five-year-olds to line up in the hall and just be quiet and respectful when they've got to walk to lunch? And then about 45 minutes into the conversation, she said to me, Lonnie, you have to understand, even the Holocaust was a manifestation of God. And I said, well, if you can't make the moral distinction that the Holocaust was caused by humans and not God, you're never going to be able to get five-year-olds to line up and be quiet and respectful in their hall on the way to lunch. If you've so eliminated hierarchy, do you understand? If everything is so equal that even the unnecessary death and suffering of 50 million people is a manifestation of God and not humanity, then you're never going to be able to have the moral authority to ask a five-year-old to be quiet. Do you see? This has something to do with the question you asked.
Yeah.
So the thing, so, you know, anyway, all good food for thought. Anyway, I completely advocate an embrace of the whole human being, and I think it's important to, you know, what is the human, this speaks to it more, what is the human expression of perfection? And I would say it's the being inspired by and striving toward perfection. We're never going to be perfect. So there has to be compassion and empathy and an embrace of that. That the expression of perfectionism is being inspired by and striving toward perfection.
And without that inspiration, it becomes judgment.
Well, then we're just sitting down in the large intestine, wallowing in it. We don't want to do that.
I think there's more to that. But,
yeah. Okay, good. We have time for probably one or two more questions. Everything seems really serious. What?
Depressed.
Everyone's depressed? I don't think everyone's depressed. Yeah. How many people feel depressed? Well, are you depressed?
I hope so.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yeah, she definitely isn't depressed.
No.
I can tell you for a fact.
Especially in the question I'm going to ask. Very serious question. Do you know why the country of Ireland is so rich? It's the richest country.
In what sense? Economically? Didn't they just have to shut down all the orphanages there because they had been torturing the children for the last 600 years? Is it a joke?
Because the capital is always Dublin. That's why it's the richest. Just needed to lighten the mirror.
Does everyone feel really heavy? Is it a bad heaviness? See, the thing is, when you talk about responsibility. Okay. Any other questions? I guess it was kind of a funny joke.
What kind of joke do you think is funny?
Funny jokes.
Hey, to me, this is like super funny.
No, my daughter will really like it. My daughter will really like it. Okay. Any other questions?
I have one more. Yeah. Selfish, though.
No, don't be ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Wait a second. I didn't get the first one. What was the punchline?
Because the capital is always Dublin. So somebody asked Rajneesh, what's the difference between heaven and hell? And he said, in hell, the German are the police, the English are the cooks, and the French are the mechanics. And in heaven, the Germans are the mechanics, the English are the police, and the French are the cooks. Okay. Now that's a very funny joke.
I guess, do you have any advice for us as you talked about us as, you know, Westerners in this time? We don't think that we have suffered much, but we're...
Well, relatively to the rest of the world. Or to most of the rest of the world. Doesn't
even with that perspective, how do you think we can alleviate suffering?
Well, I did say everybody's suffering is the same. You know, if you take a cigarette and put it out in the palm of your hand, or you're burnt on 90% of your body, it's still going to hurt just as much. If you put 100% of your consciousness into a burn that big, or 100% of your consciousness into a burn that big, it's still going to be all consumed with pain. So everybody's suffering is just as real to them. I mean, I think we see this in our clinical practices. So it's not that we haven't suffered. And we suffer in different ways. I mean, there's a suffering from soullessness.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I was just thinking when you said that.
And I mean, all my friends have been suffering since November 11th. Now we're starting to learn what it's really like to suffer.
Yeah, I mean, suffering and starvation or poverty.
Yeah, but we're not living in Somalia. But who do we treat? So the thing is, who's going to solve the problems in the world? Are the dolphins going to solve the problems? Are your dogs and cats going to solve the problems? Are destitute people all over the world going to solve the problems? Are people whose main struggle is just to get water and some food and maybe not be raped or murdered by some marauding gang, they're not going to really solve the problems. So this is an interesting question. So it appears that we've transcended the need for nation states, that we're in a global world with a global economy. If a bank goes bankrupt in Greece, it affects us. If a nuclear power plant melts down in Japan, it affects us. If the Great Barrier Reef dies in Australia, it affects us. So we have no illusions. We're in a global world. So who are the most advanced systems thinkers on Earth who understand the relationship of consciousness to the human body, physiology, culture, the biosphere and cosmos? Who are the people on the planet with the most advanced systems theory and depth of understanding of interrelationships on the planet who could design the new educational, social, political, medical, and legal systems that and military systems and strategies that we're going to need to govern a global world? Who are the people with that knowledge?
Chinese medicine,
student. Right. People of Chinese medicine. We're the most advanced holistic integral thinkers on the planet. And it's not just abstract for us. You got your hand on the pulse and you're feeling the heart and you're looking at the tongue and you're reading the color, sound, odor, and emotion and you're in the room and it's not abstract. And you put the needle in and you feel the pulse change and you understand how to eliminate obstruction and increase flow, so that an entire system moves toward a more integrated, dynamic state of wholeness. We're the ones with the knowledge to do that. That kind of knowledge only emerges when survival needs have been met. The people who formulated our, you could say, well, but didn't the people who formulate this medicine live in the Han Dynasty? Yeah, they did, but they were the richest people. They were the royal court physicians, right? Who were protected, who had the time to study and pursue the Confucian texts, who were literate. What percent of China was literate? 1%? Half of 1%? So the tradition of five elements, the tradition of the medicine, if we go way back to the Nei Ching, the Nan Ching, the Ling Shu, these texts were written by the top 0.1% of most fortunate culture. So to have that kind of sensitivity, one needs to be relatively safe and have the leisure time to really contemplate. And we have that. I mean, the people in this room have more spiritual experience than Jesus Christ did. He didn't take workshops at Omega and Eslin. Jesus didn't go take LSD with Stanislaw Grof out at Eslin and then study with Adi Don and Trungpa and then do a few weeks with Wilbur and go up to Kripalu for some R&R and take the Deepening Your Love program. So probably there's more spiritual experience in this room. He just had one little experience and stuck to it. Right? Anyway, one last question.
I have him raising one from the dead.
Well, he probably didn't either.
Yeah.
Well, with all due respect to the myth. Yes, sir, last question.
Thank you. In regards to one of your last comments about Chinese medicine being developed or created by the royalty or the upper class?
Well, from the medicine that's in the Nan Ching and the Ling Shu and the those texts, obviously, highly literate people wrote.
Do you see some bias in terms of politics playing a role in it?
Yeah, medicine is totally political. Medicine never isn't political. Mm-hmm. Though you can read the classic medical texts, you can give them political readings, just as you can give the I Ching and the Lao Tzu, you can give them political readings. They're political. All those texts will reflect back to the consciousness that's reading them, the quality of consciousness of the individual who's looking at them. So there are external dimensions to the texts and there are internal dimensions to the texts, and they can all be read as political texts. So I would say, yes, they're deeply political. Do you have anything more you want to say about that? Or?
No, just sometimes determine which part of it is more of a political agenda, trying to maybe reestablish or keep the same status quo that was going on at the time.
Well, I think that's definitely, that's true of all the traditions, aren't they? I mean, you know, for a tradition to rise in India that says you're an untouchable because of some action you took in your last lifetime, and you have to be a good one in this lifetime and fulfill your karma, and maybe you can get reincarnated into some higher body. I mean, that's as much a political statement as it is any other sort of statement. But the texts aren't just political. There are internal and there are external readings of all of it. Is there anything in the classical text that you think was politically political, particularly political?
No, it's just more the language of it that I'm thinking of.
Well, the language is significantly Confucian, but not just Confucian. There's definitely what we would call Taoism in there, although at the time it wasn't. There's naturalistic philosophy in there. There's even shamanism in there. So you can read all the texts. The reason I got into Chinese medicine was political. I told you I saw it as a vehicle for cultural change. Christianity didn't spread around the world because they had guns. It spread around the world because they opened medical clinics. So you pair the salvation of somebody's soul. You sit in the waiting room reading them the Bible while you're giving them antibiotics. It makes quite an impression. Do you see? So I think we have the same opportunity. You can't not be, if you think that politics don't belong in medicine, medicine is a perfect, you can't practice medicine without expressing politics. If somebody comes into my clinic and talks about the Jews or gays or queers or blacks or any ethnic group in a disparaging way, I can't not see it as disease. I can't not see it as disease. So any treatment I have is going to necessarily be political. Okay. So, I mean, what? Is everyone in here depressed? I think that fellow was just... When he said that, I thought he was coming from a negative, really negative place and totally off. But then I also thought, well, are people depressed? I was like, shit, I never know what I'm going to say. And I mean, there was a real gravity and some real seriousness to what I'm talking about. Sometimes I just tell jokes the whole time and get people laughing. Are you taking the class this weekend?
Yes.
I'll probably say something funny at some point.
Not this kind of joke,
though. No, it was a really good, like my daughter's 21, and between her and I, the jokes that I find funny, most of them I wouldn't tell her. Okay. Anyway, so we good?
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for coming very much. Those who are in the class this weekend, I really look forward. We're going to have a great time. It's a really deep, really beautiful class. It's one of my favorite classes to teach. And for everybody else, thanks for coming. Travel safe. Thank you.